Blog Talk Radio.
Mama Africa, Mama Africa, I'm coming home. Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I'm feeling fine, and I hope you're fine too. Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I hope when you hear these words, your gray turns blue. Gray turns blue. I'm saying these words to let you know how much I care and I won't let go. Even
another episode of Your World News. I am your host, Solomon, where each episode we try to bring you news and information that, quite simply, quite frankly, is not covered or carried or touched by the mainstream media, the mainstream Western corporate media, to be specific. And when the mainstream Western media and all of their nefarious outlets do slightly touch deep contextual issues, they're vastly, vastly out of context and purposely out of context, to continue to keep the populace and their viewers and their religious viewers and listeners and readers as dumbed down and totally out of loop as possible. And that's how they're able to continue to maintain their tight grasp on the mindsets of so many people. But here on Your World News, like so many very empowering, independent media outlets, you know, very small media outlets, I might add, we try to bring the news straight with no chaser, and in deep context and from the perspective oftentimes of those who are being trounced upon by the so-called powers that be. From the, you know, we try to bring it from the perspective of the oppressed, of the proletarian, of folks who just simply do not, of the marginalized, people who simply do not get their message and perspective carried in any context by the mainstream media. And you know, I've been away for about 2.5 weeks, so this is my first show. So if I sound excited or a little bit rusty, it's because I've had so much to tackle within this first hour. But you know, I had to take a respite and I hit the road, and I'm back now and ready to report on so much. And just because I was away didn't mean that the news came to a halt. And we certainly saw that with issues these past couple of weeks, everything from the coup in Honduras, and we see with the military coup that replaced and forcibly took out Honduran President Manuel Zelaya, and the leader of that military coup that was responsible for that was a former leader that was actually trained in the United States of America's School of the Americas. And so there's a lot of contextual stuff that I'd like to touch on right now, but can't, because we actually have a special show. We're going to be covering the corporate plunder, our third installment of The Ravaging of Africa, which is a four-part series that was tackled by Asad Ismi and was produced by Christian Swartz. And it's a brilliant, brilliant, very detailed radio documentary. And I was given the permission by Asad Ismi to rebroadcast, with his blessings, rebroadcast all four parts. And so today we're going to be covering the third part. But within the next week or so, we will be tackling and looking and having guests on the show that can really put into deeper context and perspective that coup that occurred in Honduras. And so definitely keep your eyes and ears posted for future episodes that are going to touch on that. But we also saw the charade, the bear charade, if you will. It was really interesting that involved Henry Louis Gates, Skip Gates, otherwise known as Skip Gates, and what happened in Cambridge, Massachusetts, when police came and unwarrantedly arrested him for, what they said, that they thought he was breaking into a house, but it was his own house, and they knew, subsequently when they got there, the arresting officer, that racist Crowley, when he got there, it was known that was Skip Gates' house, but nonetheless, he still proceeded to arrest him. And it's just interesting that this was like the watershed moment in Skip Gates' life, where he actually found out he was black. I mean, anyone that's been following Skip Gates, he hasn't been the biggest ally to African peoples and people of African descent, especially in America, throughout the world. He hasn't been the biggest ally. He's been a huge critic. And at one time, he proudly, proclaimed that he was 56% black. He attacked great, great African scholars and warriors such as the late, great John Henry Clark, attacked them publicly in mainstream papers and media outlets. And so he calling them, demagogues and so forth. And so, Skip Gates has been, as non-committal to the struggle of African people you know, throughout his mainstream backed career. And so it was just kind of interesting that, you know, now that he got arrested, you know, he finally realized he is black and that this is a problem. And so what was really troubling to me is that when this happened, it was just like amazing that this thing was blown up all over the mainstream, predominantly white corporate media, blown up all over, everywhere it was blown up. And it's just, and it took, you know, the arrest of, and still the white corporate media still is not really ready to admit that there's a institutional racism problem in America. You know, if you listen to the so-called pundits on the mainstream media, they were very quick to say, oh, you know, it was, you know, Skip Gates, he was mouthing out, because, you know, if you're a black person in America, don't you think about stepping outside that box and questioning, you know, our power structure. You know, our police are here to protect and serve us, not necessarily you. Not necessarily you, black community. You know, we're here to brutalize you in many instances. And if you want to step outside that box and question our power structure and our authority, we are without a doubt going to lambast and vilify and castigate you left and right. And if you're not a high-powered public figure, as Skip Gates was, you probably will find yourself behind bars, or you might find yourself, in the case of so many others, you may find yourselves behind the in front of the barrel of a gun. So I just couldn't help but see this, and I was like, man, every single week there are black men and women and people of color in general in this country that are racially profiled, that never ever have their stories told, never in any shape, form, or fashion whatsoever do they have their stories told. And so it happens to this, you know, mainstream, very mainstream, racially challenged professor from Harvard University, Skip Gates, and it's blown up all over the media's airwaves, all over the media's airwaves, in a non-contextual manner. They didn't talk about police brutality as an institution. They didn't talk about racial profiling as an institution. It was just amazing. It was. You know, and this came on the heels of that stupid CNN show called Black in America, which I recently wrote a piece about, and which will appear in next week's Black Agenda Report. And just talking about, you know, even when, you know, the white mainstream media decides to cover, you know, so-called issues in Black America, they very much do everything they can, you know, to make sure they do it very much everything that they can to keep it from a contextual shape, framework, and you know, you didn't see any stories about police brutality on Black in America. You had the inspiring story of Jeffrey Canada's Children's Zone. So they talk about Jeffrey Canada's Children's Zone, which is this, you know, this I think it's a 70 or 90 block institution for learning for youth, you know, from early years, maybe I think from, you know, 5 and 6 all the way through high school. And they focus on the fact that Jeffrey Canada focuses on health and eating habits and things of that nature to get, you know, black youth to eat better, to embrace more healthy habits. And what was interesting about that was this show, right after that segment, you know, it goes, Black in America is sponsored by McDonald's. So you find out that CNN Black in America was primarily sponsored by McDonald's, by McDonald's, just the evil corporation, McDonald's, who is directly or indirectly responsible for obesity, diabetes, you know, high blood pressure, you know, cholesterol levels, clogged arteries across the board. McDonald's serves poison. It serves poison. It serves beef that is, you know, it is pumped full of hormones, you know, bovine growth hormones. I can't say enough bad things about McDonald's. It's a horrible, horrible, horrible corporation, horrible institution, period. And so they're the primary, they're the sponsor. So it just seems to me, I don't know about you, but it seems to me if you're going to have a show that's going to focus on, that's generally going to focus on issues in Black America, and one of those issues, you know, is the health crisis and health crisis. There's a health crisis in America. America is the most obese nation worldwide, and so it affects people across the board, but they specifically wanted to focus on Black America and how, you know, health and eating habits are affecting the Black community. And so it's so disingenuous to talk about that and then to go to McDonald's as your corporate sponsor and then a slew of McDonald's commercials throughout the entire show, which feature these young, you know, these two Black youth, these two Black boys, one of which I believe was Will Smith's son, throughout, just kind of glorifying, using them to glorify McDonald's. And it was just like, I know I can't be the only one noticing this. I know I can't be the one, only one noticing this. But I know there's other people that notice this, but I don't think the other people that notice that are in the majority. I think because of the way the media operates in this country in terms of just plastering things left and right, you know, and producing, you know, viewers in mass as sheep, you know, producing these viewers as sheep. Most people don't have, you know, the critical media literacy. The critical media literacy capability to deconstruct these dominant narratives that oftentimes shape and frame their buying habits, their eating habits, and so forth. And so you have this McDonald's, and it was just crazy. So just awful, awful, awful. But that's what happens when you have the white mainstream media controlling and editing the images that are supposed to be representative and the issues that are supposed to be issues within Black America. They create the issues and they put a focus on issues that they feel are important. And it was a classic case if you watch the entire thing, especially when they looked at these youth from Brooklyn, New York, and went to South Africa. The focus clearly was on the victim, you know, blaming the victim. That, you know, the reason why these Black youth, you know, are doing poorly, it's their problem. You know, no focus on institutional racism and how it's affected school systems and the neglect that goes into Black and brown school systems nationwide. No focus on that. Even when they featured the Black youth, the African-American youth that were sent to South Africa to do some humanitarian work out there and to serve African, you know, indigenous African communities in South Africa. When they went to those Black communities in South Africa and saw the poverty, you think that there's any focus on the fact that institutional racism and white supremacy still rule the day in South Africa, even though the apartheid regime, you know, ended in 1994 and apartheid fell in 1994? Do you think they focus on the fact that, you know, over 85% of the arable land in South Africa is still controlled and maintained by white South Africans? Not a chance. Not a chance. Not a chance. So these poor Black South Africans struggling. And then, you know, you had Soledad O'Brien. So, how I don't know how Soledad O'Brien has become the expert on Black America. She seems every time there's an issue, you know, or something that the mainstream media wants to report on in terms of what's going on in Black America, they supplant her in that community and have her interviewing, you know. So she was out there and she was interviewing these kids. So, you know, and a young Black girl was crying. She was like, "Oh, are you crying because, you know, you just don't feel like you you could do anything?" And she was like, the girl nodded her head, you know. And it was just like reminiscent of like, okay, you guys may think you have it bad in Brooklyn, New York, but you know what? Look how bad they have it here in South Africa. And so, you know, cheer up. It's not, it, after all, when you compare it to South, your situation in South Africa, you know, it's not that bad. That's what it was to me. Like, that was my translation, you know, through watching it. I just thought Black America was horrendous as it was last year. And if I wasn't trying to write an article on it, I wouldn't even waste my time. I put myself through this masochistic ordeal of having to watch that series. Oh my gosh, it was horrible. And I did it because I wanted to, if I was going to write on it, if I was going to criticize it, I wanted to see it. So they could have proved me wrong. They didn't prove me wrong. But, you know, I didn't want to be irresponsible and write about something that I hadn't viewed. So I watched it, and it was an absolute ordeal. Not to say that, you know, seeing these Black people who are struggling to do great things for their community was an ordeal. No, that's always empowering to see brothers and sisters who are doing things, you know, to try to improve their community and so forth. And that's always empowering. But to watch how white America reshapes and reframes issues that affect Black America, and to reshape them and reframe them from a situation that it's about, you know, your downfall, Black person, is not institutional racism, not white supremacy. It's about the fact that you're not pulling yourself up by the bootstraps. If you simply work harder, you can do it. As a matter of fact, I'll end on this. There was a part where Soledad Brian O'Brien said, when she was talking about, I forget, it was either a Jeffrey Canada piece or there was another piece of a young brother who was a principal in Hartford, Connecticut, and there's a piece. And so she said something along the lines of, despite, you know, or she said something that barriers, you know, racial barriers or something like, I can't remember how she said it. I had written it down, and unfortunately not on me, but it is in the piece that I wrote. But she said something along the lines that, to paraphrase of that, you know, racial barriers or something like that are no excuse, you know, for doing well. It proves that, you know, racial, you know, and we know that as Africans, we have overcome throughout our history of oppression, which is a minor part of our history because our history dates back thousands of years. But when you look at the 400 years of hell that Black people have been catching in the Western Hemisphere, you know, since the time of chattel slavery, you have Black people throughout, or African people throughout the Western Hemisphere, who have overcome tremendous odds, overcome white supremacy and continued institutional racism. We know this. This is no secret to us. However, to say that, hey, you know, these are no excuses to fail. These are no excuses to fail. You know, racial barriers, there are no excuses. And she didn't talk about institutional racism in any shape, form, or fashion. But then again, of course, why would she? Why would this station, why would CNN, you know, cover that? Why would they point the finger on themselves? Of course not. You know, because for every person that makes it out from a governmentally neglected community, otherwise known as a ghetto or a slum, there are tons that are working just as hard. But because of structural racism and institutional racism and white supremacy, they can't make it out. So it's totally ridiculous to think that every person that doesn't make it out of a ghetto, you know what I'm saying, it's because they're not working hard. Now, that's total BS, total crap. So anyways, that's my rant on CNN's BS so-called piece. Called Black in America, and want to read my piece. It'll be coming out in the August 5th episode of Black Agenda Report. And speaking of Black Agenda Report, I have a couple pieces that I want you to hear. These are commentaries that you can find on www.blackagendareport.com. I've also received the blessings from Brother Glenn Ford to play these. So I'm going to play these right now, and then we're going to get into our radio documentary for the last half hour that I think you definitely will enjoy. So here we go with the first piece that talks about life in prison in terms of Blacks and Latinos and the failed prison industrial complex, the institutionalized racism, slavery that still exists in this country, otherwise known as the prison industrial complex.
The truth about race in America is most clearly evident not in the unexpected election of a non-white man to the U.S. presidency, a singular and temporary phenomenon, but in the steady march of statistics from the criminal justice system. A new report from the Sentencing Project shows that two-thirds of the prisoners serving life sentences are black or Latino. More Americans are under life sentence than ever before, more than 140,000, compared to only 34,000 25 years ago. The racist nature of the system is seen in the ever-increasing proportion of non-whites condemned to spend the rest of their years behind bars. In New York State, whites make up only 16% of inmates serving life terms, although whites are 60% of the population. Such gross racial disparities obtain everywhere in the United States. The inexorable growth in life sentences guarantees that the grotesquely distorted racial outcomes of the U.S. criminal justice system will continue to grow deep into the future as today's young inmates become tomorrow's sick, caged old men and women. Nationally, one out of every 10 prisoners is a lifer. In California, one out of five. In Alabama, Massachusetts, Nevada, and New York, at least one out of every six inmates is doing life. Seven states and the federal prison system have done away with parole altogether. That means in Illinois, Iowa, Louisiana, Maine, Pennsylvania, and South Dakota, the actuarial tables of life and death ensure the prisons will be filled by an ever more geriatric and ever blacker and browner cohort of captive men and women, grandmothers and grandfathers. Already, more than 20% of prison inmates are over 50 years old. The states have a constitutional obligation to care for the health needs of this aging population, but of course, they don't live up to this obligation. California's prison health care apparatus is so inadequate it's been ruled unconstitutional, but the state is crying broke. Prisoners over 50 cost California between $98,000 and $138,000 a year, but despite its poverty, the state remains determined to throw as many black and brown people in prison for life as possible. The sheer irrationality of U.S. prison policies points to race hysteria as the engine of incarceration. How else could we have arrived at a situation in which one out of every three black males is under some form of criminal justice custody? These numbers reflect much more than bad laws. They reveal white society's general intentions for black people. To remove as many as possible from circulation by any means necessary, with no possibility of return. When compared to the enormity of America's prison gulag, housing a million black inmates, the presence of one black male in the White House amounts to a mere diversion, especially when that black president offers virtually no hope to ameliorate the conditions of or lessen the numbers of the 1 million locked inside. America's draconian prison policies are motivated by race, not rational concerns about safety. Otherwise, the penitentiaries would not be rapidly filling up with old black and brown men and an increasing number of older women who are less and less dangerous, but more and more costly by the year. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
And that was, as he said, that was Glenn Ford from Black Agenda Report. If you are not a regular visitor to that white website, please do so from now on. It is hard-hitting critical analysis that, quite frankly, not too many sites that I've come across, you know, have when it comes to analyzing various current events, not just domestically, but globally. So that's www.blackagendareport.com. So without further ado, I want to get into Corporate Plunder, and it's a very detailed documentary. If you should definitely pass this broadcast on to, like, all your friends and all your networks, because quite frankly, people have no idea. A lot of people have no idea how Africa still is under under so much duress. I mean, so much is focused on what's going on internally in terms of the conflicts that exist in places like Congo, and you know, you see Nigeria now, Somalia, so many other places. But there's rarely a focus on the duress that Africa is facing and how these conflicts, you know, directly and indirectly are being fueled by Western nations and corporations such as Banro, Barrick Gold, you know, the Bears. You can go on and on. And so this episode focuses on corporate plunder, the corporate plunder of Africa's natural resources. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy. And if I have time at the end, I will close out. But I may not have time. This may take us right to the end of the hour. I will see you all next week for another episode of Your World News. But as I said, without further ado, here is Corporate Plunder.
The ravaging of Africa has been enriching Europe and North America for more than 500 years.
First, European empires imposed slavery and colonialism on the continent.
After 1945, the United States took over as the dominant neo-colonial power.
Through the Pentagon and the CIA, the U.S. government has fueled 14 wars in Africa with arms transfers and military training.
It's American invasion, but the U.S. role is everything.
The U.S. has used the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to systematically demolish African economies and health and education sectors.
Par les stratégies de la Banque mondiale, les pauvres seront toujours pauvres, les riches seront toujours riches.
This military and economic war enables the looting of Africa's resources by Western multinational corporations.
Shell is into the politics of Nigeria, you know. We might say we have our independence, but economically, we're still being colonized.
Washington's genocidal imperial strategy has killed more than 26 million Africans, but failed to suppress popular resistance.
We have refused to die. We are living for Africa. No matter what they do, no matter what power they have.
You are listening to The Ravaging of Africa, a four-part documentary series about the destructive impact of U.S. imperialism on the continent. I'm Asad Ismi.
I'm Christian Schwartz.
Voices and sounds in this series were recorded at the 2007 World Social Forum, held in Nairobi, Kenya.
This is Corporate Plunder, the third episode in our series. For the next half hour, we focus on the looting of Africa's abundant resources by multinational corporations. We hear from the oil fields of the Niger Delta, from Kenya's coast, and from the Tax Justice Network. Stay tuned.
A major objective of U.S. imperialism and World Bank IMF policies in Africa is to ensure that Western multinational corporations dominate the continent's economies and are able to loot them and send the proceeds to the West. As heard in the Congo, 85 multinational companies are plundering the enormous mineral wealth of the richest country in Africa. This has been made possible by a civil war arranged by the U.S. As a Congolese official said, we just watch our country's resources drain away with no benefit to the Congolese people.
This is the case for all of Africa. South Africa is the continent's largest gold producer, and most of its gold and diamond wealth is controlled by the UK-based Anglo-American Corporation, which operates in 60 countries. Ghana is Africa's second largest gold producer. Multinationals own most of the country's gold, the main source of its wealth, from which Ghanaians get little benefit. Foreign mining companies can repatriate up to 95% of their profits into external accounts and pay no income tax or duties. In Sierra Leone, the diamond multinational De Beers, as well as American and Canadian mining companies, financed a 10-year civil war that killed 75,000 people. There has been a long-standing alliance between the U.S. and multinational corporations, with Washington overthrowing progressive governments all over the South that challenge the company's control over their country's resources. This has happened in the Congo, Ghana, Somalia, Iran, Guatemala, Chile, and Nicaragua, amongst other states.
Nigeria is Africa's leading oil producer, the eighth largest in the world, and the fifth biggest exporter to the U.S. Nigerian oil is so important to Washington that President Bush has declared it a strategic asset, which means that he has authorized U.S. military intervention to ensure this oil flow in case it is threatened. For this reason, U.S. warships patrol the Gulf of Guinea from where Nigerian oil is transported. Most of Nigeria's oil wealth is controlled by the multinational Royal Dutch Shell, based in the Netherlands and Britain, and ExxonMobil and Chevron, both US-based. Shell and ExxonMobil declared record profits for 2006. In Nigeria, the oil company's policies have fueled enormous official corruption that ensures that after they grab the lion's share of the oil wealth, most of the rest is taken by 1% of the population, while 65% of Nigerians live in poverty.
Shell, the biggest oil producer in Nigeria, was partly responsible for the killing of 9 activists, including Ken Sarawiwa, by a military dictatorship in 1995. The activists opposed the company's operations due to the environmental and social devastation they caused. The Niger Delta, where most of the oil is situated, has been ecologically destroyed by Western oil multinationals. The region is the largest producer of greenhouse gases in the world. The people of the Delta remain amongst the poorest in Nigeria, while Shell has extracted more than $30 billion in oil revenue since the 1960s.
The 7 million Delta residents are mostly subsistence farmers and fishermen women, whose rivers and fields have been ruined by oil spills that average 300 a year. Many villages in the Delta have no electricity, clean drinking water, and paid employment, and most have no schools, medical clinics, or social services. The murder of Sarawiwa and the refusal of the oil companies and the government to address his concerns has led to the rise of a far more militant indigenous protest movement, led by the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, or MEND.
Since January 2006, MEND has been engaged in a major insurgency, kidnapping foreign oil workers, blowing up pipelines, and killing Nigerian soldiers. This has dramatically reduced Nigerian oil production by 28% and that of Shell by a crippling 50%. It has also caused world oil prices to rise. MEND opposes the environmental devastation of the Delta caused by oil companies and wants the region's oil money to go to its people. The group is fighting for total control of oil wealth by the people of the Delta and demands reparations from the companies for their pollution. MEND has warned the oil multinationals to, in its words, leave our land while you can or die in it. The group has made clear that its aim is to totally destroy the capacity of the Nigerian government to export oil.
Afenia Lart is president of Women Light Foundation, a non-governmental organization that works in the Niger Delta. She is from Bayelsa State in the Delta and belongs to the Fangbe community. Women Light Foundation is linked to Friends of the Earth International.
They are creating a war within Nigeria, this oil company, using our own people to kill our own people, whether they are militants or they are militants that are genuine. They are all Nigerians, and it's a sad thing. And I don't see a reason why Nigerian military that's supposed to be defending our people will go there, get killed by their own people, and the people get killed by them. Because the people have to protect themselves. How long will this continue? I know that there is one group that is men. Those groups are genuine. They know what they want. They have a plan. They want a government to look into the situation in the Niger Delta. Communities should take charge of their natural resources, be it from any ethnic nationality in Nigeria. Communities should take be in charge of it, whether it's gold, whether it's marble, solid or liquid minerals. Communities should be in charge of it.
An expansion of the insurgency could stop all oil production in the Delta.
I pray that it stops oil production. And once if it stops, I'll be happy, because Shell, if I were Shell, I would stop exploring for more oil. Take a stop and try to at least make amends for the mistakes, the errors they've made.
The oil companies are responsible for enormous environmental and social destruction in Nigeria.
Whenever there is rain, the whole rain is black. If you use this normal drink to roof your house, in less than 3 months, it will be leaking because of acid rain. when we harvest food from this land, now we eat it, the food tastes like gasoline, the fish tastes like gasoline. Almost everybody suffers from asthma in the Delta. My community has the right to breathe good air. My community has the right to have good, pure land which they can farm on. My community has the right to clean water.
Shell does little to remedy the harmful effects of frequent oil spills.
Oruma, it's a community in Bayelsa State. The spill was so bad that it got into their pit, so there was no water, no food, and Shell did not even bring any relief material for them. Children were asking for water. There were lots of respiratory diseases, and the whole community there smells good. If you are there for like 10 minutes, you start choking. So I wonder how people there are surviving, you know. Another example I've been to is Goi, where the whole creek is burnt down. You can't even see one single fish. No crab, periwinkles, everything is gone. And there's this community I went to Goi last November, also in Ogoni, that you see oil well boiling. And the youth said that they've gone to complain to Shell that Shell didn't do anything about it. They said they will come. And as soon as I left that place, less than 5 minutes, the oil well blew out into a big fire. Yes, very huge fire. And they said that the oil well has been leaking like that for 2 years.
Oil operations in the Delta have had a particularly negative impact on women.
Coupled with the oil company came with the sex industry. When they came, they have money, they spend the dollars, and the people are so poor. So the women go into prostitution, you know, especially child prostitutes. And I think this has contributed to the spread of HIV.
The oil multinationals are the richest and most powerful corporations in the world. In league with the US and other Western neo-colonial powers, they dominate the government of Nigeria.
What can the government do? I don't think the government can do anything. Shell is into the politics of Nigeria, you know. We might say we have our independence, but economically, we are still being colonized. Of course, they are multinational companies, and I think they are bigger than my country. So I don't think my president can just wake up one day and ask Shell or any oil company to leave, and it's going to be easy. I know he feels this blow, this pain, but there is nothing. He's a third world president. There is nothing really much he can do for now.
Shell is so powerful and...
Powerful internationally. I was surprised. I went to Amsterdam and they are doing the same thing they are doing here in their own home country. They are in complex of Nigeria, so far away.
What are they doing here?
There is a community we went to, Panis. The air in that community smells like rotten eggs. Take for instance Port Arthur in the US. They are doing big refineries without even looking at the people at the fence line. These are big countries, you know. If they can't control them, is it Nigerian government that can control them? But I would want to see that if this oil company stops putting pressures on in my country's politics, you know, intervening in my country's politics. And I would like to see that they stop pointing at my government as being corrupt, my people as being corrupt, and not just my country, in every other country. I would wish that they stop getting into politics in any country.
And how should Africa as a whole deal with this multinational corporation?
Oh, that's a hard question. How should America deal with the multinational corporation like Shell? How should Netherlands deal with their own Royal Dutch Shell company? They control the world. I think that countries like America, Netherlands, the king. They should do something about it. Because they're still the economic colonial masters.
Friend to prominent secretary, friend to minister, friend to head of state, then stop, to steal money, stop, then corruption, stop, then inflation, stop, then oppression, stop, then confusion, stop, then oppression, stop, to steal money, stop, to steal money, like Obasanjo and Abiola.
International
business, ICC. International rule.
International.
Canadian companies are prominent in Africa, especially in mining. Canada is the world's leading nation in the area of mineral exploration, and 60% of mining multinationals in the world are Canadian. There are more than 170 Canadian mining companies in Africa with 530 properties. Canadian mining companies have become notorious for environmental destruction and human rights violations all over the world. 10 Canadian mining companies with investments in the Congo have been benefiting from its civil war. These include Barrick Gold, Canada's biggest mining company, and Banro Resources. Barrick and Banro have held mining properties in eastern Congo under Rwandan and Ugandan control. Both companies have been accused of funding military operations in exchange for lucrative contracts. In Ghana, more than half of the 200 active mining concessions belong, at least in part, to Canadian companies.
In Kenya, the Canadian mining company Tiumen Resources is in the initial stages of setting up a titanium mine along the country's coast near the town of Kwale, which is 65 kilometers south of the city of Mombasa. Kenya's coast is a beautiful tropical paradise with 250 miles of palm-fringed beaches and blue lagoons. It also has a fragile ecosystem. Titanium is a mineral used in the manufacture of aircraft, cars, and tennis rackets. Tiumen calls Kwale Kenya's biggest mining operation, which is projected to generate over $40 million annually and is worth $922 million. The mine threatens to displace 500 Kwale residents and destroy their community. The residents refuse to leave, and this has stopped the project for the moment. Tiumen's strip mining will also contaminate air and water, remove all vegetation, and spread radiation. Kenyan scientists warn that it will never be safe for people to return to Kwale after it is mined.
Mwana Siti Bijuma lives in Kwale and is a community mobilizer for the group Muslims for Human Rights, or Muhuri, which opposes the project and is organizing against it in collaboration with three other NGOs, non-governmental organizations, Action Aid International, Kenya, the Kenya Land Alliance, and the Coastland Rights Lobby.
People's land will be destroyed, the social cultural places will be destroyed, the kingship will be destroyed because people will go through different places. People worship graves, or this is the ancestral land where people, fathers and forefathers were buried. Their shrines are there. People always treasure and worship these places. All this thing will go just because of something called titanium. My family has lived there for generations and generations. My father, my great-grandfather, my great-grandfather, my great-grandfather. Those people have lived there since the colonial period. My great-grandfather's grave is there. My great-great-grandfather's grave is there. My grandmother's grave is there. My grandfather's grave is there. And today, someone is telling me to move out of that place just because they think mining is the best. So how do you think I'll feel? Where will I take those graves? My kids, where will they go? Where will they call a place where they used to know? It is really terrible. A place where you have always called a home. Today you can't call a home just because the government and titanium thinks that they need money.
The people of Kwale are farmers.
People who live there, they depend on agriculture. They dig the coconut trees that live there. They take the coconut there, then they sell. That's what they sell. That's what they eat because they dig. Then that's their food. People plant skuma, maize. Maize, then they grind, then they get flour. They plant tomatoes, they plant vegetables, so many crops. There are trees like coconut trees, there are mango trees which they depend on for their daily bread, will also be destroyed.
Although Tioman's preparations for the mine are in the exploration stage, they have already had negative health and environmental effects.
In 1997, they came to our place. They just said they wanted to do a trial so that they can see if the titanium is there. And when they did this trial, there were so many effects in our places. Two kids already have become blind in Kwale, in Sambweni district, when they were just doing that trial. And then the water became dry in our place. So we were told that titanium needs a lot of water in order to be manufactured. So these wells have become dry. And then the ones that were left became, there was a cottage of oil on top, but we didn't know what it was. Then a man took that oil and gave this chicken, and 100 chicken died at the same time.
Tioman and the Kenyan government have failed to consult the Kwale community, especially on the crucial matter of compensation for displacement. The company has offered 80,000 Kenyan shillings per acre, about $1,500, to residents, which they've rejected as inadequate.
It's still the government plus titanium who sat down and thought it is supposed to be 80,000. And they didn't still include the community or the CBOs, community-based organization, or any person from the community they didn't involve. This 80,000, is it for a one family or is it for a polygamous family? Because there are people who have a husband and plus five wives or five children. What about these women whose husband have died? What was that 80,000 for? Was it for that man who has that land, who owns that land, or is it for everyone? That 80,000 is also for buying land.
The Kenyan government will only get a 2.5% mining royalty from Tioman.
Why we refused the second thing was that all this money that they are going to make, billions and billions of money, why can't they give, and what will the community benefit out of that? What will Kenya benefit out of that? Because they said annually, Kenya will get 2.5% annually royalty. What is 2.5%? And yet they're getting billions and billions of money out of that place. Is this company going to bring benefit to Kenya, or is it going to bring crisis to Kenya? Are we trying to improve the poverty ratio, or are we trying to decrease it? Is this Tioman bringing blessings to us, or is it bringing curses? From our seeing, we see that it's bringing curses to us, because people will get blind, rivers will dry, people will suffer.
Like the people of the Niger Delta, the people of Kwale know that their perilous situation is a result of Western neocolonialism.
We don't trust the government. It can be bribed from colonial period. We have visited the colonial, but I think we're still there. Because of late, you're not even free. Because everything we have to do, maybe we have to go, we have to ask permission from G states. You know, we are not as independent as we think.
Nigeria and Kenya are only two amongst many African countries whose resources are being looted by Western multinational corporations. An important aspect of this thievery is tax looting, which is facilitated by a global infrastructure of corruption set up by Western governments and corporations in collusion with the World Bank and the IMF. This infrastructure includes many tax havens, banks, false transfer pricing by corporations, and the imposition of very low tax rates on African countries.
The result is that Western multinationals pay little tax to African governments and are able to extract a massive amount of capital from the continent. The African Union estimates that $148 billion leaves the continent illicitly every year. This money goes mainly to the US, Britain, and Switzerland. An astounding 30% of sub-Saharan Africa's GDP has been moved offshore. To expose this phenomenal looting, African and Western economists and activists set up the Tax Justice Network at the World Social Forum held in Nairobi, Kenya, in January 2007. Charles Abugre from Ghana spoke for the Tax Justice Network at the forum.
Africa is usually considered as an income-poor country, a capital-poor country. In reality, since 1995, Africa has been a net capital exporter to the developed world, and in massive quantities and values. This capital export is usually very simplistically referred to as monies looted by African governments and African elites to the north. The story is a lot more complex than that. Our estimate is that of all resources that flow out in net terms from Africa, the share of corruption in that outflow is less than 10%. Even the corrupt money do leave Africa because the environment and the mechanisms are in place that attract and suck out the money. Corruption per se is not a good thing, but it will always be reinvested if it doesn't have a haven to go to. Tax havens, banking secrecy is the major mechanism that encourages the sucking out of money from Africa.
John Christensen is an economist and a director of the International Secretariat of the Tax Justice Network. He is a former economic advisor to the government of Jersey, a major tax haven which is part of Britain.
Every dollar of aid that the West gives to Africa, $10 of dirty money flows out from Africa, heading northwards into secret bank accounts and offshore companies. Over the last 50 years, a shadowy economy of tax havens and offshore finance centers has been created. These places are very secretive. At the moment, there are about 72, maybe 75 tax havens around the world. Some of them are very small islands, but some of them are major finance centers, like the City of London, like Frankfurt, New York, Luxembourg, and other major centers like that. The vast majority of multinational corporations make extensive use of offshore companies in order to avoid paying tax in the jurisdictions where they make their profits. Chevron, Texaco, Shell, a whole host of extractive industry corporations have been involved in this. Those in the West, particularly the Western governments like the British government, the United States government, the World Bank, who point the fingers at Africans, really should begin by tackling their own poor governance and their own corruption. A starting point is to close off the secrecy space and this corruption interface of tax havens, which enable and facilitate and encourage corruption in Africa.
Many multinational companies combine the use of tax havens with corrupt trade pricing policies that also enable massive tax looting.
And they do this largely through transfer pricing techniques where they export their commodities out of Africa at very low prices and import into Europe and North America at high prices, leaving the profits in offshore jurisdictions where it's tax-free.
For example, there are some studies show that between 1996 and 2005 alone, the loss of money as a result of either low pricing of exports to the United States, only as an example, or high pricing of imports from the United States, lost Africa in net terms over $31 billion. If you extrapolate that the United States is only has 40% of the total trade volumes of Africa, then we are talking about a minimum of $75 to $80 to $100 billion. That flow out in trade misinvoicing. That is transnational companies that are importing and overpricing, exporting and underpricing the exports that they give.
Along with tax havens and false pricing, a third tactic that enables corporate tax looting is the US's use of the World Bank to force African governments to reduce their taxes. This is known as tax competition.
And tax competition that forced African government to reduce taxes almost to zero, basically getting entirely nothing from the natural resources, which is their main source of revenue. And Zambia is a very ridiculous situation. In 2004, Zambia exported what they quote is not really what the real value of exports are. They quoted $1 billion of exports from the copper industry. They paid the Zambian government $8 million of total revenue. But the real value, if you then factor in this mispricing that I talk about, you will be thinking about between $2 to $3 billion. Entire revenue share of the mineral wealth to the Zambian people is $8 million out of a declared $1 billion. Now that is scandalous. Or this is about 0.6%. Now that means that all of the price booms in the commodity sector is not going to benefit Africa at all unless you address transnational companies basically ripping and ripping the continent of resources.
You have been listening to Corporate Plunder, the third episode of the documentary series The Ravaging of Africa.
The Ravaging of Africa is dedicated to the memory of Patrice Lumumba.
This series was written by Asad Ismi and produced by Kristen Schwartz. go to www.asadismi.ws. That's www.asadismi.ws for more information or to download the series.
Translation by Maziar Mahajir at Toronto Conversation Corner and Farid Omar. Voiceover by Benedicta Madavo.
Theme music is Nerbalankina by Captain Yaba from Ghana.
On this episode, you also heard International Thief Thief by Fela Kuti from Nigeria. This series was funded by Canadian Union of Public Employees Local 3903, QP National, Canadian Union of Postal Workers National, CUBW North Bay Local, Canadian Labour Congress, Public Service Alliance of Canada, Ontario Secondary School Teachers Federation, Ontario English Catholic Teachers Association, Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and Mining Watch Canada.
Thank you for listening.
And that was The Ravaging of Africa. That was the third installment of the four-part radio documentary. And within the very near future, I'll be airing the fourth part. And so please, definitely stay tuned, and we will be airing the next part. And if you can just forward all this information to your friends and your family, that's knowledge is power, and that's one of the best ways that we can raise the specter of consciousness, which many, many times equates to some type of organized activism. I emphasize the word organized. We have to remain organized. We have to be in solidarity, and that means that we have to mobilize our communities, before all that happens. So continue your great work. Continue to struggle. Aluta continua. This is Solomon for Your World News. Until next time, be blessed.